Well, good morning. I am so delighted that you're not sick of Luther yet, okay? We got some interesting information coming up in the next few weeks, and today's one of them. Today we're going to be covering material that probably is not the material that you've traditionally learned about Luther, but it's very, very fascinating. We've been exploring the story of Luther and the events and the ideas that will, within a short number of years, result in the Reformation and the creation of a new branch of the Christian faith known as Protestantism, the tradition that we stand within. And so last week we left off with what is considered to be Luther's great theological breakthrough. It's referred to as the Tower Experience. You can actually Google that if you want to. He tells us in 1542 that this happened in the year 1519. This is the great theological insight. All the beliefs that Luther has, pretty much most of them have been there either by Wycliffe or by Jan Hus. So they're not unique and new. This one was. This was unique to Luther, and it's a great gift. It is widely considered to be his single greatest contribution to our movement and to Protestantism around the world. And it later became the theological, the key principle. So if you're within a Protestant tradition, one way you know, are we in a Protestant tradition? If you find the language of either justification by faith or justification by faith alone, that will tell you. In our tradition, we use the term justification by faith. We do not use the alone part, but we stand within this tradition. In the year 1520, this is the next year, this is following Leipzig, which happens in July 1519, following the Tower Experience, which happens sometime after Leipzig, we're not exactly sure when, Luther is going to burst upon the world, and this is an understatement, an unparalleled period of writing and publication. It is unlike anything the world has ever seen. The result is going to be that he's going to issue a series of writings, numerous, but there are five in particular, that literally lay the theological foundations for the Reformation and for the Protestant movement that we're a part of. So today we're going to turn to the story of Luther, the writer and publisher. A lot of this is going to come from one of the new books that's out called Brand Luther. I love the little blurb here. How an unheralded monk turned his small town into a center of publishing, made himself the most famous man in Europe, and started the Protestant Reformation. How's that for a resume? Okay, yeah. You know, we talk about, you know, why was Luther able to be successful when others were not? Part of it is he's protected by his prince, Frederick. Part of it is he's just stubborn as an ox. Part of it is the Gutenberg printing press, but we don't need to sell short the fact that he was a uniquely gifted writer, and he's uniquely gifted in the area of publishing, and this is not material that I knew that well in the past. So we want to turn to this, his writing, his publication, and specifically how does this feed into the Reformation, because I think you can probably credit this aspect as much as anything with the fact that the Reformation actually got off the ground. So next week, we're going to explore five writings, the key five writings that laid the foundation for Protestantism. But today, what we want to do is sort of back up, pan back, and just talk about Luther, the writer, Luther the published. Now, at the end of Leipzig, as we mentioned last week, or 2 weeks ago, there was a broad consensus, and Luther would agree with this. Luther was defeated by Eck at Leipzig. Eck simply got the best of Luther, and he maneuvered Luther into saying some stuff he probably, at least initially, regretted saying. One of which was he admitted that he had more in common with a condemned heretic than he did with the current leadership of the church. That's not something you normally want to admit standing in front of a big room full of church leaders, but he was maneuvered into that. It's at Leipzig that Luther also realized that because, and Eck, among others, was advocating this, the church at that time held the authority of the Pope to be above the authority of Scripture, that because of that, reform was impossible. You simply cannot reform a church. This, remember the three walls of the papacy that he attacked? The papacy had three aspects, basically, which came down to this. Nobody can reform the church except the Pope, and the Pope doesn't want to. And there you have it, okay. So Eck may have won the debate, but here's one of the great ironies of history. It didn't matter because history had moved on. No one cared, okay? No one cared that Eck won. Nobody even cared to hear what Eck had to say. At this point, the train has left the station. You know. In the wake of Leipzig, who do people want to hear? Who are they excited about? Who's the guy that's saying things that they just simply can't believe are being said, and really they begin to feel passionate about? And that's this new, what is called the evangelical, or the reformed message that Luther and others are beginning to put forward. So after Leipzig, we're going to see a shift. We're going to shift from the debate stage. The debates are over, okay? Heidelberg, Augsburg, Leipzig. Now, there will be, not a debate, but there'll be a confrontation at Worms later. But essentially, we've shifted. We're shifting off that. We're now shifting to what are known as the print wars. We talked a little bit earlier about some of the print wars right after and 17, early 18, as Luther follows up the 95 Theses. But this is where it really takes off with spades. It's going to be Luther who is the clear winner of this contest. He may have lost the debate, but that's irrelevant. He's going to win this war, the main one. Luther was quite literally going to bury his opponents in an ocean of print, okay? He is such a prodigious author that nobody can even begin to comprehend. I mean, we'll see a little bit about that. He's prodigious, and that's probably an understatement. He's also a pioneer. Luther is credited with creating writing styles, creating communication styles, and creating forms of publication that the world has not seen, and these things begin to make a huge difference. He's given credit, for example, for creating an entirely new form of writing. It is short, it is clear, and it's direct.
And it's in German.
What? And it's in German. Yeah, that's a big piece of it too. But the traditional form is what's called the scholastic approach, and this is who can outquote each other on different obscure references, and how can you make something that could be done in two paragraphs 600 pages long, you know, this scholarly stuff, you know. And so to his credit, what Luther's going to realize is that doesn't cut it. What's going to cut it today, because of his audience, and who's he writing in German to again?
The masses.
The masses, okay. The masses can't read Latin, and they sure as heck can't read Latin medieval theology, okay? But they can read what Luther's about to cut loose with. This new form of writing is not directed at the cleric. It is not directed at the professional scholar. By the way, heretofore, all writing is connected or aimed at those people. We do not have popular novels. We do not have popular, you know, writing to the common masses. At this point in time, all writing was to the professional, okay? He's going to direct his writing at the ordinary, everyday person. This is shocking to people. It's one of the things they try to wrap their minds around. Well, how could you do that? You know, this doesn't make sense to them that he would do that. He revolutionizes the print industry. He creates an entirely new form of communication called the pamphlet. Now, today we know the pamphlet. They did not know the pamphlet. They knew tomes, you know, big, thick tomes, okay? Pamphlets are a perfect way of expressing Luther's brand new way of communication. Pamphlets are going to be the main weapon in the war that we're about to come, in the battle that's about to come. Pamphlets are short. They rely on brief, clear statements instead of long, scholarly comments. They're designed to quickly get the reader's attention and to move you emotionally, not necessarily intellectually. Okay? Yeah, I'll convince you the truth, but if you don't move somebody 18 inches below their head, that's what sermons do, right? Sermons are not geared here, they're geared here. Medieval sermons were geared here. Luther's now going to aim here. He wants to move people. Very famous name, Lucas Cranach. He's going to help Luther. This is one of the master printers of the age who becomes Luther's ally, and he introduces something called woodcut illustrations. Have you ever heard of those? Those very famous, nasty cartoons. You know, the Pope depicted with nine heads, you know, all that kind of stuff. Okay. We begin now to have audio-visual, or at least visual aids into the writing. Woodcuts. We're going to put cartoons there. We're going to poke fun at, you know, at the Pope and other peoples. You know, this adds more emotional impact. Yeah. Now, because pamphlets are not aimed, what?
You don't have Lucas Cranach in here.
No, I added that this morning early. Sorry about that. Mea culpa, mea maxima culpa. Okay. I cannot leave it alone. I just have to add to the last second. Okay. But Cranach is actually a big piece of the story, and he's worth almost a session by himself, what they were able to do together. Now, because pamphlets are not aimed at clerics and scholars, what they do, which is brilliant, is they invite the common human being into a discussion they've been excluded from. They're invited into the process of being able to talk about theology in a society and day and time where ordinary lay people were excluded from those conversations, you know? And it helps them understand that what's at stake is not just these obscure out-quoting each other type things, but some of what we're talking about here is relevant to everybody's life. Is being what salvation means, is that relevant to your life? What God would want you to do, is that relevant to your life? What is a waste of your time, is that relevant to your life? And so Luther is applying that material. The academic style, the medieval style, which is done in Latin and done with scholastic rules of argument. If you want to know what those are, read the 95 Theses. That's an example of that. If you ever have insomnia, read the 95 Theses. It will work every time, okay? That's not comprehensible to anybody except this small, minuscule elite of people who've been trained to think that way and to argue that way. For the vast majority of people, the academic treatises are gibberish. And we actually have people who lived in that time saying that. There's a guy named Matthias Mahler. Now, he was an observer at Leipzig debate. Now, what you need to know about Matthias is this. He's no country bumpkin. He's among the most highly educated people in Europe, okay? He's not a clergyman. He's not studied theology formally. But he's a very, very educated, articulate man. This is what he says. He was there at Leipzig, and what he heard was simply this, a chaotic sea of words, you know. He couldn't make head nor tails of it because they're trying to outquote each other and do those kinds of things. By the way, that still holds true to seminary for some degree. And books that have all the footnotes where they argue with all the other authors, okay, it's still a common disease. It's Luther, and this is part of his brilliance, who realizes this is a problem. If most people cannot make heads or tails out of this, we've got an issue. But if we can bring the average ordinary person into the conversation, then things might change. So it's Luther who will become the master of communicating with the masses and ordinary people. And it's quite clear that this is intentional. This is not accidental. Luther was extremely strategic in this. He writes a little bit later a dedication to the Treatise of Good Works. The Treatise on Good Works is one of the five treatises of 1520 that changed the world. And he writes a little dedication. In this, he gives us a wonderful insight into this aspect of his thinking. He says, I know full well, and I hear every day, that many people think little of me. Probably mild. And say that I only write little pamphlets or sermons in German. These are all discounting things. And these I write for the uneducated laity. These are all ways of discounting Luther. Luther, you just write little pamphlets, you just write little sermons, you just write for the laity and you just uneducated. You know, nothing you write is significant. That's what he's saying. I do not let that stop me. Would to God that in my lifetime I had, to my fullest ability, helped a single layman to be better. I will most gladly leave to everyone else the glory of the greater things. I will not be ashamed in the slightest to preach to the simple and educated layman and to write to him in German. It seems to me that if we had hitherto busied ourselves at this very task and were of a mind to do more of it in the future, Christendom would have reaped no small advantage and would have benefited more by this than by all those heavy, weighty tomes and by all those questions that could only be handled by the schools and by the learned scholars. Bing in the eye, you know. This is what he's about. He's telling you, this is what he's about.
How was this distributed, Walt?
Printed.
I know, but newsstands or?
How did it get? There would be booksellers in the community, and I'm not sure if people went out and hawked him or not, but by the way, this writing, this particular one here, at the time is one of the hottest selling things that have been in print. It's sold.
Okay.
People are willing to pay money to have this. By the way, footnote, people are not willing to pay money for what the Catholics are putting out. This has profound implications. December 1519, a printing house is established in Wittenberg. Now, there was a printing press there that Luther and other scholars had access to as a part of the university, but a guy sets up shop. And we now have a business of printing. This proves to be very timely. Well, why? Well, shortly after this, Duke George blocked the printing of Luther's works throughout the kingdom of Saxony. Saxony, by the way, is where all the major print houses are located, Leipzig being the center of the industry. So the prince says, he's a pro-Catholic, I'm just going to cut the spigot off. Luther will not be able to print anything. Well, he did, except there's a print house in Wittenberg. And history rolls forward. Between the years 1518 and 1520, Luther's literary output is so great, buckle your seatbelt, this is apparently true, he outprints the next 17 most popular authors combined. Okay? How he does that, I do not know. His output, Luther by himself is printing or writing 20% of everything that is being printed in Germany, period. It's a tsunami of print. By 1522, Luther has published over 160 works, which went through 828 printings. The result is hundreds of thousands of individual pieces by Luther floating around out there in a population of what percentage are literate?
5%.
My thought is your typical literate person has an armful of Luther, okay? Between 1517, when Luther published his 95 Theses, and 1546, when Luther died, buckle up on this one too, Wittenberg, which was nothing, becomes the largest center of printing in Germany, some will argue in Europe. It rivals anything in Europe, okay? It just becomes printing center. During that period, I don't know who counts this, but somebody has way too much time on their hands, 2,721 separate, probably a PhD dissertation in this, separate works printed in Wittenberg. They go through multiple printings. The result is about 3 million pieces of literature out there, of which Luther has written 1/3. There's 1 million pieces of Luther out there just kind of floating around.
Just Wittenberg or just all of Germany?
Wittenberg.
Oh my God.
Yeah, just Wittenberg. I mean, it's spewing out. This is all in brand Luther. Yes. This is correct, yeah. Pretty much if Luther had the thought, it's in print. And you can access it, okay? He simply outproduces everybody, Catholic or Protestant. There are other writers out there. There are other great writers out there, but he just drowns them. Okay? His enemies, are you shocked? They could not keep up. Well, how bad was it? Well, Luther, and this is what Catholic opponents will say, my God, we're just trying to respond to this, and he's written 3 more. You know, how do you do that? How do you keep up with a guy? You can't get a response in print before he's hit you 3 more times with other things. He outproduces his most successful Catholic opponent 30-1. The single best-selling Catholic author. Yes?
How broad was the German language across Europe?
The Holy Roman Empire, which would be a big hunk of it, would be German. Beyond that, you're going to go to other things. And there's not one German. One of the things that Luther will do later when he translates the Bible.
He reaches much of Europe, if not most.
He's reaching the Holy Roman Empire. And this stuff is also being translated. And like Latin, German would be, because of the Holy Roman Empire, it would be a language that if you're literate, you probably know some of that. And so, yeah, it spreads very, very quickly. Okay? He outproduces the combined output of all Catholic writers combined. 9-1,
wow.
You know. How do you handle that? You don't, you know. In the miracle year of 1520 that we'll look at next week, he writes 28 works, of which they'll go through 300 printings, hundreds of thousands of pieces sold 1 year. Of these 28 writings, 16 are major works, 5 change the world and launch the Reformation. Sometimes people say 3. There's the last 3 of the 5, but we're going to add 2 more because they do. These 5 are just absolutely pivotal. Luther's enemies are not going to give up. They try to attack back. Well, 60 Catholic authors over attack Luther and attack his beliefs. Over 200 books and pamphlets are printed against him, but his opponents continue to make the same mistake over and over. They attack him in Latin. Yeah. Not exclusively. There are some wise ones who go after him in German, but the vast majority are writing in Latin, okay? Most people don't even know what they said. You know, it just goes over the head, makes no impact whatsoever. By the way, this is surprising to me. This is intentional. They're writing in Latin, and they're writing in the scholastic style deliberately for a reason, you know? And they are just as deliberate about that as Luther is deliberate about using the German language. There was a prevailing view at this time that theological issues were the business of the ordained clergy, and they're the business of professionally trained theologians. And the common folk ought not get involved in that kind of thing, okay? It's not the business of the common, uneducated layperson to delve into matters theological. That's the prevailing thinking. So we have a Franciscan, Thomas Murner, who is one of those who attack Luther in the wake of Leipzig, and he's one of those who insists on doing so in Latin. And he has an interesting little insight. He said the reason he did this was that the common person was easily misled. Matters of faith should not be disputed before the ignorant common folk. You might argue that that may be the single biggest mistake made in the 16th century, you know, because, you know, they're reading Luther. What this meant, unfortunately for them, was nobody read it. Nobody heard it. Message didn't get out. Talk about shooting yourself in the foot. Common ignorant folk are very interested in what Luther had to say. And guess what? They're willing to pay money to hear it. Yes?
Where did the money go? Who benefited? Was it Luther himself or the printers? Or
Luther never got a penny off anything he ever wrote. It goes to the printers. The way the printing industry worked is you take the risk. You print something. If it's a loss, you take the hit. If it's a profit, Mark Craig would have loved this approach, right? You know, you take the hit, you take the gain. Okay. Well, that was the idea. And so printers got savvy real quick, and you're only going to print stuff you think you can sell. And this began, this story kind of rolls down this. So this is Lazarus Spengler. He's a lay person. He's a Nuremberg civil service secretary. He's a highly educated person, not a cleric, not a theologian. So he says, he's talking about Luther's writings. Whether Luther's teaching is in accord with Christian ordinance and reason, and the Pope is arguing what? It's not, and Luther's arguing it is. Whether that's true, I leave to every rational, pious person's judgment, which is interesting because one of the things it says is he's not leaving it to an institution. He thinks that each person can decide for themselves, which is interesting in itself. But this I know for certain, that although I don't consider myself to be particularly skilled or intellectually educated in these matters, I have never known a teaching or sermon to pierce my mind so strongly my whole life long. That's why Luther is selling. His message is getting through. Across the empire, printers are eager to print the new evangelistic message. Very good reason, obvious reason. People want to hear it. They're willing to pay for it. And we will print anything people want to buy. Okay, so they're right after that. All of Luther's writings sold. By the way, they sold at levels no one has ever dreamed of. They cannot keep his stuff on the shelf. It just flies off the shelf, going, you know, being sold. Prophet sword. Catholic writings don't sell, okay? Because what are the Catholics doing? They're arguing for the status quo. They're arguing that things should not change. You see the same old stuff over and over and over, okay? 1520, another Luther's opponent named Johannes Cochlaeus wrote a rebuttal of Luther's to the Christian nobility. That's one of the five writings to look at next week. Here's what's interesting. By all accounts, this is a masterpiece. By all accounts, this is an exceptional work, masterfully written, well argued. It's the kind of thing that if it got out, Luther would have had to deal with, and it would have given him a lot of grief. He read Luther, he understood Luther, and he went after Luther. The problem was simply this. Cochlaeus could not get anyone to underwrite its printing. True story. You know, nobody would do it. No printer is willing to take the risk, knowing it was unlikely that anyone would purchase it, and they would simply lose money.
How did the other Catholics who were rebutting him, how did they get their stuff from?
To a large degree, they didn't. We're going to see, part of the story is, the print industry in the Catholic area, particularly Leipzig, collapses. The entire printing industry at Leipzig collapses, and people are out of work. Now, Rome will pay for some stuff. Bishops, cardinals might pay for some stuff. But by and large, printing in Leipzig and the Catholic area simply shrivels up like a prune. Meanwhile, what's happening down in Wittenberg? They can't keep it, they can't keep it on the shelf. They're both in, but they're two different areas. Luther's under Frederick, you know, got a different prince up north. Prince up north is loyal to the Catholic position, tries to shut the whole day. Talk about shooting yourself in the foot. He won't let his printers print anything Luther has written, anything about Luther, or anything any reformer has said. So he forbids them to sell anything that will make money. And he forces them to sell what? Stuff that will not make money. Okay, yeah. The dramatic result of this is that the printing industry in Leipzig, which is the center of Catholic printing, literally, this is actually true. It simply collapses.
Therefore, write in Latin or in German?
Do not know. My guess would be probably Latin. Most of it written in Latin. Some wrote in German. Not Eck, but who was the other one? Cajetan went after Luther in German, as did originally, who's the first person Luther went up against? Sold the indulgences. Yeah, Tetzel. Tetzel was sharp. Tetzel printed some stuff in German. So there were some people who could see, yeah, Luther is fighting on that battlefield. I've got to fight on that battlefield to combat him. But most of them simply did not do that. I think he died right about this time, about 1520. They're forbidden to print Luther's work. They're forbidden to print anything. They can only print Catholic works. Nobody wants to buy it. Okay. During the same period, what happens in Wittenberg? Well, different story. The little town of Wittenberg becomes the center of the printing industry in Germany, one of the powerhouses in Europe. 1516, the year before he posted the 95 Theses. Think about it. Luther is a literary, he's literally published nothing. He's an unknown. 4 years later, as we approach 1520, you can say 3 years later, Luther was the most famous man in Germany. Why? Because of his writing. Very few people ever met Luther. So how would they encounter Luther? There's a million pieces of literature out there that Luther's responsible for. There's another profound shift in the landscape that, again, is directly connected to the writings of the Miracle Year. Prior to Leipzig, and there's some quotes from Luther in this, but it was real clear, he was not ready to break with the church. He still held out hope, that the church somehow could be reformed. Wrote a long piece to the Pope, trying to convince the Pope. Well, that didn't work. Leipzig makes Luther realize that the break's inevitable, and in the year 1520, there are more events that's going to drive this home for Luther. And it's going to provoke him not only into formally breaking with the church, but into laying the foundations for an alternative church, which is what we're going to see happen next week, what we today know as Protestantism. The first major event was a move made by the Pope. June 15th, 1520, 3 years after the Theses, a year after the Tower experience, the Pope issues a papal bull, Exsurge Domini, Arise, O Lord, and defend the faith. In that, the Pope warned Luther that he would be excommunicated unless he rejected 41 specifically named statements and beliefs that Luther had made in his writings. So it's pretty much everything Luther had ever said, you know. It's all bad. Here's part of the text of Exsurge Domini. This is from the Pope. We condemn, reprobate, and reject completely each of these theses or errors as either heretical, scandalous, false, offensive to pious ears, or seductive to simple minds. He's writing to the people in German. Okay. and against the Catholic Church. Okay. Yeah. By listing them, these 40-something, we decree and declare that all the faithful, if you're a good Catholic, must regard them as condemned, reprobated, and rejected. Likewise, we condemn, reprobate, and reject completely the books and all the writings and sermons of the said Martin, whether in Latin or any other language, because some of Luther's stuff's now been translated into other languages. We forbid each and every one to read, assert, preach, praise, print, publish, or defend anything Luther has said. After the publication of this letter, these works shall be burned publicly and solemnly in the presence of the clerics and popes. To Luther, okay? To make his point, the Pope then has all of Luther's writings gathered up. By the way, they have a big supply because they've been judging whether or not these are heretical, you know. So they got a big, big pile. And they burn them publicly in the Piazza Nirvana in Rome, which you can still, there's a pretty fountain there now, but back then it was a little bit different story. The Pope gives Luther 60 days to respond. That's 60 days upon receipt of this bull, because it's going to take a while for the bull to get to him. It actually takes about 4 months. 10th of December, 1520, Luther responds, classic Luther style. He burns publicly the bull and all the Catholic works in Wittenberg on the day that his excommunication would have been official. Okay, so I don't think the timing is particularly by chance. Luther would later explain this is what he did. Since they had burned my books, I burned theirs, you know. And the canon law, which he also burned, he got all the copies of the canon law, the official rules of the church and the papal decrees. Canon law was included because it makes the Pope a god on earth. At this point, we're way beyond Reformation. We're at war.
By the way, I think it's still up, but you can see that a copy of that bull and the response over
right
in Bridwell
yeah
on display right now.
So you go straight.
Haven't had a chance to go over there and see the Martin Luther thing,
exhibit,
all the stuff we're talking about. There's a bunch of his Bibles, his sermons, the responses, mm-hmm, the bull.
Just you can't read Latin. There's little cards by each one explaining what it is. But you can read in Latin, Exsurge Domine. It is
there. Bridwell Library, right? I'm pointing the wrong way.
Yeah.
I have a terrible sense of internal direction.
It's right there?
No, it's right there.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, Bridwell Library. Just there's an exhibit.
Yep, it's in the, how long was that exhibit there?
Just
another week or two, okay? And you go straight in, you can see Martin Luther's name in the back, and then it's centered to the right. Excellent. Superb exhibit. Maybe the last chance you have a chance to see this stuff. Yes, Mary?
Is it weird that common people couldn't even have the Bible available in the churches?
Yeah, because at this point in time, a couple of things going on. One, the Bibles are all in Latin. And secondly, who can read Latin? And there's this idea that the theology is of such a nature that the common person should not delve into things they simply cannot understand. Leave that to the professionals. Yes, Cheryl?
Where is that exhibit she was talking about?
If you go straight down the parking lot up there, you know where Perkins Chapel is? Just go past Perkins Chapel at a 90-degree angle facing us is Bridwell Library, and you walk straight in there. It'll be open this afternoon till 2 o'clock.
No, and at
2 till, yeah. And it's open late at night, too, so you can go, too. Well worth saying. Yes? Yeah. But they weren't expected to understand theology. They just did things. Go to Mass. Get baptized.
Yeah.
Pay for indulgences. Pretty much the common person's faith was all through acts, what Luther would call works. Luther is going to introduce the idea that through a belief I think he actually, some people say, regretted coming up with, the priesthood of all believers. There was a little bit of regret there, but the idea that anybody can have direct access, one of the most radical beliefs there is. Okay, between these two, Exsurge Domine, burning of the books, June 15th, Luther's burning of the bull, December 10th, Luther is going to blast his enemies This is a quote. By publishing five of the most incendiary and influential documents that shall ever be written in any language anywhere. Just, not one, just ba-da-ba-ba-bam, lays them out. It's actually in a six-month period. These five works lay the foundations for the Reformation. They lay the foundations of Protestant faith. These five writings are the reason why 1520 is simply referred to as the miracle year. Probably any one of these would have got that. So next week, we're going to turn to these five, and we're going to look at the year and take them in chronological order that they were written and just sort of walk through that. So buckle up. Yes. I think most scholars would say both. For example, he clearly inherits some of the Enlightenment. Is that right? No, Enlightenment, 1700s.
Yeah, 18th century.
Yeah, the Renaissance that he's actually part of. But part of what comes out of that is this stress on the individual. And Luther clearly inherits that, and he also clearly moves the ball down the field with that. So we have the humanists that he's a part of at the very beginning, and they're very much into the individual, they're very much into learning, they're very much into reason. They're very critical of the medieval church. They're critical of indulgences, they're critical of a lot of stuff. So Luther starts out within kind of, he's perceived by Erasmus and others as being one of them. Very quickly it becomes clear that Luther's a different breed. So it's both. He's part of the age, but he clearly impacts what will come. Yes.
I wondered, to what degree did the people know how to read?
The question is, to what degree do people know how to read? The statistic that I hear for the 16th century is roughly 5%. 5% of the people can actually read, which even when Luther is successful and he changes the church, he's gonna replace the sacraments with a new focus on preaching. So why would you focus on preaching rather than reading? Because people can't read. Today we talk about reading scripture, but in the Reformation it's a real stress on the preaching because most people sitting out there can't read, so the only way they're going to get this new information is by coming to church and simply listening to it. But 5% is what you sort of hear.
Some of what's over there in Bridwell are some like children's primers that he published. So he sort of starts a movement towards teaching the masses to read. So they're you know, sort of like alphabet books like we see today, but these beautifully published children's primers for reading.
He's particularly into teaching children to read.
Was the rumbling, was this like totally new to the masses, or was there rumblings within the masses? Who influenced who? Were they taken totally off guard by Luther's, you know, the indulgences of that or everything, or were the people, the masses, kind of going?
There had been for two centuries people upset with the way things were going. Mm-hmm. So in the 1300s, you've got John Wycliffe in England advocating the power of the laity, advocating the Bible in the common language, many of the things Luther does. A century before Luther, in the early 1400s, a person in the Czech Republic gets accused of being a disciple of Wycliffe. His name is Jan Hus. And then Jan Hus gets picked up by Luther. Luther had not actually read Hus. He just knew generally some stuff. But when he finally reads Hus after Leipzig, he realizes, oh my God, I agree with a lot of what this guy says. Yeah.
What about the mass population, though? Were they educated in this, or was this totally like...
The feeling I get is that... the term we'd say today is this goes viral. And it's generating a humongous amount of excitement. So much so when Luther travels from one town to another, crowds go with him.
So it was really him that planted the seed. The general public was a little bit clueless.
The soil had been prepared by others. But he's the flashpoint. Luther's the one who really gets it going. Indulgences were hated by a lot of people. They were already highly controversial. They've been criticized for two centuries. So when Luther takes that on, one of the things he does is he hooks into some real dissatisfaction. He also hooks into the fact that all the money is leaving Germany and it's going to Rome. And the princes care about that a lot. Okay, so yeah, right man, right time, right place. The soil is ready, it ignites.
So is there any indication that the common people before Luther were upset? That they were, protesting or rioting?
That's good. The question is there evidence that the common people were upset? We know that there are peasant revolts repeatedly over time. So, there would be some of that against the church, but a lot of it would be against the ruling elite of the community. One of the things that's going to happen in Luther's life is that his writing on Christian freedom, he's talking about religious freedom, but a lot of people are going to interpret that as political freedom. And there's going to be a peasant's revolt in which many tens of thousands will die, and Luther is criticized for his nasty response. He basically says to the princes, anarchy is the worst thing that can happen. Kill them all. The irony is he says this after they've already been massacred. But the fact that he puts it in print and they've been massacred is tied to him.
That was previous to his 95 thesis.
No, this is after. This is after what we're looking at, yeah. Last 20 years of Luther's life is very controversial for his view of the Jews, the peasants' revolt, and the way he treated his friends. Yeah. We're going to quit before we get to the nasty stuff. Just his impact on the faith, I think. Okay? Yes?
What was going on with the Holy Roman Emperor at the time? Because Martell and Hammer helped push the Moors out of Spain and so Charlemagne,
right,
while they power became the Holy Roman Emperor, even though he kept his concubines,
yeah,
and everything. And there were a series of Holy Roman Emperors. And
right.
Germany wasn't consolidated during this period of time.
300 separate kingdoms.
Yeah,
the question is, what role did the Holy Roman Empire? Not, well, for one thing, if Germany is 300 separate kingdoms, each with their own prince, how much power does a emperor have over 300 separate kingdoms? Not as much as he would like to have. The other thing is, there's a lot of politics going on here. Rome wants Luther dealt with, but they're far away. If they can talk the Holy Roman Emperor into doing that for them, score. That's what Worms is going to be. The problem is the local prince down where Luther is, Frederick, loves Luther. And he actually is not just one of the 300 princes, he's one of the seven electors who elect the new emperor. So one of the things that happens for a while is we got an emperor we know is about to die. He's on his way out. Do you really want to offend Frederick by going after his monk? Probably not. So we're not going to get into this much, but politics play a huge piece of this. I mean, and Luther can play the political game. He can write to Frederick and talk about how innocent he is when he's clearly not, you know. And so all this is flying around kind of thing. But yeah, the emperor plays a role, but not as far as I can tell, not a huge one because his power is limited. And it's also, for example, one of the other things you've got the Moors or the Ottomans, who are on the steps of Vienna. Okay, you need troops from the Holy Roman Empire to stop them. So even the Pope in Rome does not want to alienate the princes in Germany for fear they may not give the troops that can stop the Ottomans from coming. Same thing happens with the Emperor. He does not want to alienate Frederick. Frederick's supposed to supply some troops. So it's a real convoluted kind of thing. Luther benefits from all that. People got powers bouncing off each other. In the meanwhile, Luther just keeps going.